sugar in the United States posits that it takes only 3 weeks of regular overstimulation for addiction to take hold and the receptors in our brain to thin out. And once those receptors downregulate, several things happen. First, as I said before, life in between eating feels bleak, which is one of the links between the standard American diet and depression. Second, the ability to taste food actually diminishes. Not only that, studies have shown that the anticipatory expectation of food in the brain of an obese person is much greater than in a slender person's. But when they eat, the pleasure they derive from the meal is lower. In other words, if you're on one of those diets we discussed in Chapter 1, and you start to think about how amazing it would be to eat something off your plan, your brain is exaggerating the payoff that food is going to deliver. But when you actually eat, the payoff won't come. You'll just be left craving the next hit. I used to live like that. Late nights scavenging the supermarket aisles for cookie dough ingredients, pints of ice cream, bags of chips, and boxes of pasta. I'd go home and eat compulsively, waiting for some feeling, a feeling of being done, that never came. I would finish the whole bowl, the bag, the pint, but I was never done. Until I was done with sugar and flour completely.
Case study, Dennis Fansler. Highest weight, 280 pounds. Current weight, 181 pounds. Height, 6 feet, 0 inches. I grew up eating the standard American diet. Lots of meat and potatoes, lots of sweets. Add to that life's stressors, and a few years ago I topped out at 280 pounds. I felt so depressed and isolated. For 35 years, I'd been trying to control my relationship with food, but after so many failed attempts, I thought it was just hopeless. Then, after a bad heart scan indicated some blockage in my coronary arteries, I got so scared I lost 50 pounds over the next 6 months. But as was common for me, I quickly started to gain it back. Then I came across Bright Line Eating. I was impressed by Susan Pierce Thompson's story and the information she shared in the Food Freedom video series. I committed to the plan, and my weight dropped off really quickly. I lost 35 pounds in the first 70 days and got down to a weight that's lower than my college football days when I had about 10% body fat. My waist went from about 40 inches to 32. My blood pressure went from 120 over 80 to 100 over 60, and my cholesterol went from 237 on 20 milligrams daily of Lipitor to 160 with no medication needed. But more than that, I appreciate the structure and support I have found in Bright Line Eating. I know that while I'm happier and less stressed, I need to keep working on the inner change, and Bright Line Eating gives me a space and framework to do that. The greatest change is my newfound belief that I can stay in this new body and spend my time helping others instead of obsessing over food. Bright Line Eating worked for me when nothing in the last 35 years ever had. I tell people, be prepared to change your life, not just your body size. Anything short of total change is a waste of time.
Chapter 4, The Susceptibility Scale. So now we understand the three ways the brain blocks weight loss, and everyone is equally exposed. We are all saddled with the willpower gap because we all have an anterior cingulate cortex that gets fatigued by checking email and holding our tongues. And we all have opportunities throughout the day to fall prey to the willpower gap because we're confronted with sugar and flour everywhere we turn. So, given all this, the next natural question that arises is, why isn't everyone obese? It's a very legitimate question. And I have an answer for you. Essentially, everyone's equally exposed, but not everyone is equally susceptible. Let me explain. A lot of people think that addiction has to do with the substance. That heroin, for example, is inherently addictive, and therefore anyone who uses heroin for any extended period of time will, by definition, get hooked. Now, if you're defining addiction in terms of tolerance and withdrawal, then maybe so. Yet, if we send 100,000 people home after surgery with several weeks' supply of Vicodin, what we'll find is that some won't take it at all, others will wean themselves off easily despite the withdrawal symptoms, and some will become truly addicted. Alcohol is both addictive and widely used, but we all know that not everyone becomes an alcoholic. Some people can be on and off again smokers, or drink caffeine only when they want some. In essence, some people can take it or leave it. And some people just can't. When it comes to sugar and flour, I erroneously assumed for many years that either you are a food addict or you are not. Certainly, in food addiction recovery programs, the first step is to decide whether or not you're powerless over food. But when I looked at the problem as a scientist, I started to see a more nuanced picture emerge. Human traits tend to fall on a bell curve. Why shouldn't addictive susceptibility follow this pattern as well? Now, this wasn't idle intellectual curiosity. The more I applied this idea to people I was working with, the more it became clear that I was onto something. There were lots and lots of people who clearly weren't food addicts to the degree that I was, and they weren't about to go get help from a 12-step food addiction program like I had used, because they truly didn't belong there. Yet they were addicted to food to some degree. They most definitely had a weight problem, and they knew the usual diets were never going to work for them. I came to believe that in order for them to get truly happy, thin, and free, they would first have to understand how susceptible their brains were, and then proceed from there. And that's why I created the susceptibility scale. The susceptibility scale ranges from 1 on the low end to 10 on the high end, and it helps you understand how strongly your brain reacts to the reward value of addictive foods. When I first began to develop this idea, my email list had several hundred subscribers, and I was writing about the susceptibility scale regularly. People wrote in asking if I had a quiz or an instrument that would tell them how susceptible they were. Creating just such an instrument became one of my top priorities. So I developed the susceptibility quiz, also known as the food freedom quiz. It's only 5 questions, but they target exactly the dimensions that differentiate people for whom food is not an issue from people who battle its addictive pull. The quiz is framed to analyze your relationship with food during your worst 3 months of eating behaviors. Why? Because once you've engaged in behaviors like regular binge eating, those fiber tracks are laid in the brain. They might not be active anymore, but they never go away. So you'll always have to be more vigilant around food than someone who has never struggled in that way. Are you curious to know how you score? The questions are simple, but the scoring is actually quite complicated, so I've set up a quiz online to calculate it all for you. You can go right now to www.foodfreedomquiz.com and find out your susceptibility score. I'll explain your results to you when you get back. Go ahead, press pause. It's only going to take you a couple of minutes. I'll wait right here. Foodfreedomquiz.com. Results. 1 through 3, low susceptibility. In our ancient evolutionary past, low susceptibility probably wouldn't have conferred a survival advantage. But in today's obscenely abundant food environment, you can consider yourself lucky. Your body gives you reliable signals about when to stop eating. In fact, if you're among the lowest of the low, you may even have the problem of not thinking about food enough. If you're engaged in a busy day, you might actually forget to eat and have to organize your life to remember to eat the right foods at the right times. When the movie The Curious Case of Benjamin Button came out, Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett were on Oprah. And a fan, who happened to be a chef, offered to cook them their favorite foods. She asked them what they most loved to eat. And both movie stars sat there, stumped. After several awkward moments, the best Cate Blanchett could muster was, "A bowl of rice is nice sometimes." And Brad Pitt chimed in with, "Yeah, food's not really on my radar screen." I was floored. How could they not know what they most love to eat? This was so not my experience. Oprah leaned out to the audience and declared, "I don't know about you all, but I could never say what those two just said." And everyone laughed and the tension was broken. But if you're low on the susceptibility scale, that's what your relationship to food is like. Food is simply fuel of no particular interest at all. Or it's a momentary pleasure that quickly passes and then is forgotten. So if your score is in the 1 to 3 range, can bright line eating still be helpful? Actually, yeah, it can. One of my online boot campers, Darlene Seva, was a serious runner. She trained regularly and had run 28 marathons during her adult years. But then, in 2013, she had a serious upper cervical neck injury and was forced to stop running. Despite the fact that she'd always been a careful eater, within a year she'd gained 28 pounds. Not a huge amount of weight, but it bothered her. She knew a lot about nutrition and had tried multiple diets, but none provided enough guidance on exactly what and how much to eat, so she stayed heavy. Finally, someone told her about the Bright Line Eating Boot Camp, and she signed up. She lost her excess 28 pounds quite rapidly, is now living happily at goal weight, and continues to do Brightline eating to this day. Despite the fact that she's only a 2 on the susceptibility scale, she loves the structure that Brightline eating provides and the clarity that it brings to her eating. She finds that so long as she sticks with the plan, she stays easily and exactly at her goal weight. If she deviates a bit, she momentarily gains a couple pounds. But since she's so low on the scale and doesn't care much about food, sticking with it is super easy. Hence, she loves Brightline eating and is delighted that it solved her weight problem. Surprisingly, many people who are overweight or even obese are low on the susceptibility scale. The combination of a slow to normal metabolism, coupled with mindless consumption of the quickest, cheapest, most palatable foods around, will pack on the pounds, addiction or no. And if getting that weight off becomes a paramount concern, Brightline eating can easily come to the rescue. Other people who are low on the susceptibility scale seek out Brightline eating simply because they want to be the best version of themselves, eating whole foods and living in a body with a balanced insulin system that has consistent energy for all of life's adventures. But for people on the low end of the scale, it's a choice, not a necessity. Scores 4 through 7, mid-range susceptibility. If you're in the mid-range, you may think of yourself as being somewhat challenged by food. How challenged probably depends on whether you're overweight and whether or not you have health issues. But you're no stranger to cravings. Given the hyper-palatable foods that exist today and their near-constant availability, mid-range people are in danger of becoming overweight just by eating too much of the wrong foods. Or even too much of seemingly healthy foods. I recently had a woman in my boot camp who is a plant-based eater and very health conscious, but before the boot camp, she was eating too much flour, which was making her sedentary, depressed, and frustrated, because she thought she was doing everything right. Now she's finally lost the 40 pounds that plagued her for years and is full of energy. About 24% of the people who sign up for the Brightline Eating Boot Camp are in the mid-range on the susceptibility scale, and they tend to get fabulous results. When you've experienced cravings, stubborn weight gain, and persistent overeating despite a desire to get trim and healthy, finally getting happy, thin, and free is a huge relief. My mother is also in the mid-range on the susceptibility scale. She's done the boot camp and is a bright lifer. I know her relationship with food almost as well as I know my own. When she deviates from the bright lines, it's not devastatingly painful and all-consuming like it is for me. and she finds it much easier to get back on track. But over the years, she's discovered that there's a very strong correlation between how free she feels and how faithfully she sticks to her bright lines. She embraces the bright lines because they give her full and complete liberation from any mental chatter about her food, and because she loves having her food handled, and of course, living effortlessly in a right-sized body. Scores 8 through 10, high susceptibility. If you're highly susceptible, you've probably struggled with your eating and or your weight for years, if not decades. The signals that tell other people to stop eating just don't work reliably, and it's possible they never did. You might be a foodie with cookbooks lining the shelves, or you might not care at all about the fanciness of the food you eat and just spend your mornings thinking about your coffee and donut, or three. On the susceptibility scale, I'm a perfect 10. Now, there are many times in life when it's awesome to be a perfect 10. This isn't one of them. In fact, to quote the movie This Is Spinal Tap, I probably go all the way to 11. What does that mean? Well, it means I can't count points. I can't have a splurge day or even a splurge hour. I'm looking at you, carbohydrate addicts diet. I can't eat a slice of pizza on Sunday and go back to salad on Monday. And if I do have a slice of pizza, I want many more. Then I go hunting around for some cookies or chips or ice cream to wash it all down with. I've been known to rearrange a whole day so I could drive across town to satisfy a specific food craving. Eating past the point of fullness was a common occurrence. And all of this bothered me. A lot. I thought about it way more than I wished I did, and I tried ad nauseum to get my food choices and my weight under control. At times, I'd feel like a certain plan or a certain approach was working for me, but those periods of time never lasted, and before long, the struggle would be back. Essentially, my brain is wired to ensure that I would fail at every diet I ever tried. Only the bright line eating approach worked for me. Here's the simple truth. Plans based on moderation do not work for people who are high on the susceptibility scale. Now, a word about the developers of diet and health-related programs. By and large, they tend to be in the low to mid-range on the susceptibility scale. Since they are not overly susceptible to the pull of addictive foods, they are able to solve their weight problem with diet and/or exercise, or they may never even have had a weight problem at all. Then they write a book about their success and sell their plan as a solution that will work for the masses. Well, if you're high on the susceptibility scale like I am, then you and I both know it won't, because we've tried them all, and nothing worked. Whether you do bright line eating or not, I want you to become a savvy consumer of diet and exercise programs. When you're presented with a new plan, I want you to ask yourself, where is the creator of this program on the susceptibility scale? And then look for clues in his or her story to try to answer that question. If it's a plan designed by someone whose susceptibility score appears to be lower than yours, odds are that the solution they're peddling isn't going to be potent enough for the way your brain is wired. Skinny highs and big lows. If you've taken the quiz and your results surprised you because of your appearance, please do not assume that just because you're slim, you will be low on the scale, or just because you're heavy, you will be high on the scale. Yes, susceptibility is correlated with weight, but not nearly as highly correlated as you might expect. In fact, a full 22% of people at a normal weight are actually high on the susceptibility scale. In my psychology of eating class, I used to draw a big circle on the board, and I'd tell my students, this big circle represents your actions, your attention, your life, the sum total of every thought you have, everything you do, and everything that matters to you. And then I would ask them, what proportion of this circle is taken up by thinking about what you've eaten or not eaten, whether you've exercised or not, whether you're on your food plan or off? And semester after semester, I'd have a slender student in the front row whisper in shame and horror, 95%? Where does this come into play? These frequently are the people who, 20 years later, will enter my boot camp saying, "I don't understand what's happened. I was always thin." Thin until. Until they took a sedentary job. Thin until they gave up sports. Thin until they got pregnant or went through menopause. On average, American adults gain 5 pounds every holiday season, and don't lose them. Those pounds add up. A slender person who is high on the susceptibility scale and who doesn't have any resources may run into trouble with their weight at some point. Or they may not. They may just spend their life as a skinny person restricting, binging, purging, over-exercising, abusing laxatives, counting calories, and obsessing over every morsel of food and every pound of weight. Their quality of life will be diminished every single day as they suffer quietly with a problem that doesn't make any sense and that they think no one understands. They struggle. They just don't wear the evidence on their bodies. On the other end of the spectrum are people who are overweight, but who are low on the susceptibility scale. And here's the thing about that. People forget that addictive substances have heightened reward salience, even for people who are not addicted. In other words, sugar and flour taste good, and they feel good. Every brain loves that nice rush of dopamine. So even if there's no downregulation in the mix, sugar and flour can easily trick you into eating too much of them. This is how, in our current society, people who are in the low or mid-range of the susceptibility scale so easily become overweight. Foods made mainly out of flour and sugar are readily available, easy to grab, and screaming to be put in our mouths. Before long, our baseline level of insulin has risen and our leptin is being blocked. So our brains think we're starving and we unwittingly eat more and more. In modern day life, it's becoming the average natural state. The data. We have a large and rapidly growing bright line eating community, and we occasionally run campaigns to educate people about their susceptibility score and what it means for their life. Over 350,000 people have taken the quiz so far. It's important to keep in mind that this is anything but a representative sample of the overall population. People, by and large, are drawn to bright line eating because they're unhappy with their weight, their relationship with food, or both. Of course it makes sense that the distribution of respondents would be heavily skewed toward the high end of the scale. So, my team and I decided to find out what the breakdown is in the U.S. population at large. Representative samples of the entire population are exceedingly hard to come by, but there are research companies who perform surveys just like this and who do it well, so we hired one of them to find out for us. And here's what the results show. The scores are relatively even across the scale, with maybe a slight hump a few more people in the 7 to 8 range. But roughly speaking, one-third of people fall into the low end of the range, one-third are in the mid-range, and one-third are high, with about 18% of people in the very high range, that 9 to 10 type score, which actually mirrors research from Yale University showing that roughly 19% of the population are food addicts. Now, this is very interesting because we have rat data on addictive susceptibility, and curiously enough, rats are just like us. One-third are highly susceptible to addiction, one-third are moderately susceptible, and one-third are just not susceptible at all. That non-susceptible third just don't care too much about the intravenous cocaine. Once it's gone, they're not hunting around for more. They behave like they're thinking, "Okay, that was nice, but I don't miss it." They might be the Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett of rodents. Goal trackers versus sign trackers. I want to go a bit in depth here about how scientists discovered that one-third of rats are prone to addiction and one-third are not. This research gives us a window into what it is that makes someone susceptible to addiction in the first place. What exactly is it in our environment that triggers such vulnerability in some of us? It's an important question that yields some truly empowering answers. In 2006, at the University of Michigan's Molecular and Behavioral Neuroscience Institute, Shelley Flagel performed some telling rat experiments. She and her team placed rats in standard cages that included a simple, retractable lever and a food dish. At random times, the lever would suddenly pop into the cage, and it would stay there for 8 seconds. At the end of the 8 seconds, the lever was retracted, and a food pellet was delivered to the dish. Now, the rats quickly associated the arrival of the lever with the arrival of food. Now, that's straightforward because we are all, rats and humans alike, fast at identifying the cues that tell us that food is coming. The smell of bacon, the sound of plates being put out on the table before dinner, the sight of a meal coming together on the stove. Across all of our senses, there are cues that make us salivate. But what electrified the researchers is what happened next. When the lever appeared, some rats immediately ran to the dish and waited for the food to arrive. These were the goal-tracking rats, and their behavior was expected. They were waiting for the goal, the food. But other rats, lots of them, ran over to the lever instead. Not the life-sustaining food. No, they loved the lever, the cold metal lever, which provided no tangible benefit to them whatsoever. They nuzzled it. They sniffed it. They scampered around it. They couldn't eat or drink it, yet their brains quickly adapted to tracking for it and released dopamine when they saw it. Their lives quickly became oriented around the lever. The researchers called these rats sign trackers because they were pulled in by the sign, the cue, that was associated with food. What this means for us: eating, cues, and emotions. So you might be thinking, but I don't have a lever come into my kitchen before I cook. How does this apply to me? Well, if you're a human being who is powerfully attracted to the cues that predict food rewards in our society, then life might go something like this. You're walking in a mall and suddenly you're drawn down a corridor and you don't even know why, because you didn't even register seeing the Cinnabon sign out of the corner of your eye. But you did. Your brain picked up on a cue that predicts reward. Or you're a teacher and you're just walking past the lounge when you get a glimpse of a pink box through the window, and before you know it, you're deciding to go talk to a colleague you see in there. And of course, eat a donut or two. Our highways are one long path strung with reward cues. Golden arches, a purple bell, a giant ice cream cone. We are inundated with visual reward cues. But visual cues aren't the only cues. Time of day is also a powerful cue. If you always drive to a Starbucks to get a pick-me-up on the way home, you are cued to want caffeine and sugar at that time of day. Or when you've finally gotten your kids down, that means it's time to go sit on the couch and have your reward. This is a very common one and closely tied to the willpower gap. Think about how much willpower was depleted just getting you to that moment. In fact, the willpower gap comes into play across the board, because even if you're vigilant 95% of the time, there will be times during the day when your anterior cingulate cortex fails, leaving you vulnerable to the pull of those cues. Maybe you're eating because it's Friday night, or because your favorite show is on, or because you're on vacation, or because you're reading. These are not just habits for you. The things that, in the past, you've associated with eating can become like gravitational forces keeping you trapped and circling in their orbit. Emotions are also very powerful cues. Whether due to boredom, anger, celebratory joy, fear, insecurity, grief, loneliness, frustration, happiness, or sadness, emotional eating is as common today as mindless eating. We even call it comfort food, for goodness sake. And these messages start young. A few years ago, I took my then 2-year-old on a car trip to visit Niagara Falls with a friend of mine who is also a bright lifer. We had a great adventure, but when it was time to get back in the car and head home, my daughter refused to get clicked into her car seat. She started arching her back, pushing against the car seat, and wailing. Typical behavior for that age. My poor friend watched the mayhem for a few minutes, and then she started rummaging in our cooler. She handed me a plastic baggie full of crackers and raisins to give to her. I threw it on the floor of the car and finished clicking in my daughter. Then as I climbed into the front seat to drive off, I took a deep breath and decided to offer a different type of food. Food for thought. As lovingly as I could, I said to my friend, "Do you see what you just did? Maya wasn't hungry. She was angry about having to get clicked into her car seat. You wanted me to give her food, but that had nothing to do with what she was upset about. Do that often enough, and you'll teach your kid that negative emotions are a cue to eat." She was blown away, and as we drove back, we talked about how her mom had done that exact thing to her as a child. If those connections between uncomfortable emotions and hitting that dopamine release valve are hardwired in childhood, over time, emotions become the cues that predict food rewards. And when a child is crying, a parent never says, "Would you like some broccoli?" It's usually a cookie, a cracker, or another sugar or flour-based treat that's offered. People talk a lot about emotional eating. According to this way of looking at it, if emotions are your cues, then they're your cues. All of us sign trackers have a range of cues that pull us toward food, and emotions are usually in the mix there somewhere. People frequently say to me when they start my boot camp, "I just need to heal these emotions, and then I won't overeat anymore." I would posit that you might simply need a system that teaches you how to break the behavior of acting on the cue. One last thought about this. If you're a goal tracker and food is rewarding, but the cues that predict it aren't, then it will be pretty easy for you to stop overeating. You have to give up the excess food, and that's it. But if you're a sign tracker and you get powerfully pulled in by the myriad cues in life that predict food rewards, then quitting addictive eating is an entirely different ballgame. Your whole life has become one big series of cues to eat. The pull is invisible and incredibly strong, and escaping can seem nearly impossible. Impossible, that is, until you adopt a method of eating that was designed to solve this exact problem. Nature versus nurture. Before we end this discussion of sign tracking and goal tracking, I want to address one lingering question you might have been pondering. Is addictive susceptibility genetic or environmental? Well, scientists have done the research, and it turns out that, in rats at least, it is powerfully genetic. Sign tracking rats mated to other purebred sign tracking rats nearly always give birth to baby sign tracking rats. Goal-tracking rats mated with purebred goal trackers nearly always give birth to baby goal-tracking rats. Addiction runs in their genes. But then the researchers did another ingenious experiment. They took two non-addictable goal-tracking rats and mated them together. So they got a whole litter of non-addictable babies. Then they took some of those babies away and raised them in isolation, which is stressful for a rat and mimics emotional trauma to a human child. Many of those babies turned into addictable rats. Other researchers showed that stressing the baby rats by making food rewards uncertain could also result in goal-tracking rats acting like sign trackers. Essentially, put under enough stress, a genetically non-addictable rat can be turned into an addictable rat. It doesn't happen every time, but it happens often enough. Now, I don't know about you, but I teared up the first time I read that. It answered a lot of my own questions about why some of us are more prone to addiction than others, why some of us end up on the end of the bell curve where we don't want to be. It also started to address a lot of questions on the forefront of addiction research, like why so many combat veterans develop addiction after serving tours of duty. Nature and nurture are interesting topics, but at some point, spending too much time wondering why you became susceptible and when your food problem originated amounts to navel-gazing if you're not also embarking on a proven program of action to solve the problem. And the biggest obstacle to succeeding in that program of action, funny enough, is probably not going to be the big food manufacturers or your mother-in-law's freshly baked cookies. It's going to be you. But not all of you, just a part of you. A part I like to call the saboteur. outwitting your saboteur has everything to do with understanding how your impulses originate in the brain. And that's what we're going to cover next.
Case study, Karina Flora. Highest weight, 225 pounds. Current weight, 134 pounds. Height, 5'4.5". I have struggled with my weight for as long as I can remember. I was 9 years old when I went on my first diet. I can't even tell you how many times I've tried to lose weight in my lifetime. I've tried Weight Watchers more than once, Atkins, Overeaters Anonymous, The Zone Diet, Dr. Oz's Diet Plan, Dr. Phil's Diet Plan, Suzanne Summers's Diet Plan, The Blood Type Diet, and the Honey, Lemon, and Cayenne Fast. I know there have been others, but I can't remember all of them. I lost the most amount of weight when I turned vegan. That lasted 10 months, but I just couldn't sustain it. I got down to 163 pounds, but then I gained it all back, plus more. I'm definitely a food addict, a 9 on the susceptibility scale. I used to eat when I was happy, sad, stressed, bored, you name it. I could always find a reason to eat. After having 2 kids and juggling the demands of a very busy life, their school and activities, running my own business, working on my degree in podology, and maintaining a household, my weight crept up to its all-time heaviest of 225 pounds. I looked happy on the outside, but on the inside I was so disappointed that I couldn't get my act together, not only for me, but for my family. Emotionally and physically, I was tired a lot of the time. Once I was finished with work and the many things that had to be done every day were done, I would often relax in front of the TV for hours and snack. Then my mom sent me the links to Susan's Food Freedom video series. When I watched them, they totally made sense to me. All of the programs I had tried before had usually focused on food or exercise, but none of them had really focused on the behavioral part of eating. That was the missing link for me. I worked through the program exactly how Susan teaches it. I did not break my bright lines once throughout my whole weight loss journey. After just the first few weeks, I started feeling great. I loved not having to worry about my food. There was nothing to obsess about. I lost 11 pounds in my first week and had so much energy I started organizing and cleaning my house. I was finally starting to feel in control of my life again. My journey hasn't been without struggles, of course. At first, going out to restaurants was a bit stressful. The fear of the unknown was difficult. Would they be able to accommodate me? Would I get enough food? But the celebrations and rewards I've experienced with Bright Line eating far outweigh the struggles. When I started, my goal was to lose the weight before I turned 40 and to finally put my food issues behind me. I was tired of feeling like I was missing out on things in every aspect of my life, especially with my husband and kids. Well, I'm happy to say it happened. I reached my goal weight the day before my 40th birthday. I was so thrilled. I've experienced many physical benefits as well. I have a lot more energy. I don't have the same kind of aches and pains as I did before. Getting up off the ground and simply moving is effortless now. When I go out for walks, I want to push myself more because it feels so good. I easily wake up at 6 a.m. every day. I don't have to drag myself out of bed. I have a new sense of self-confidence and take pride in how I look. I love that my body finally reflects how I feel on the inside. Accomplished. Food was one aspect of my life I could rarely control, and when I did, it didn't last long. Now I have the confidence to take chances I might not have taken before. I feel like more business opportunities will open up for me. I'm excited to see what will happen. My thinking about food has totally changed. It doesn't feel like I'm on a diet or like I'm following a particular program anymore. It's not that I can't eat certain foods. Truly, I don't want to. I'm never white-knuckling around food because I never give my taste buds a reason to want it. The enjoyment that I might get for a few moments is not worth the sugar crash and the addictive behavior that will follow. Nothing tastes as good as living happy, thin, and free feels.
Chapter 5, The Saboteur. For four chapters, we've been talking about how eating the standard American diet can hijack and rewire the brain. But what does this sound like in your head as you're going around living your life? Many of us who've tried to lose weight in the past can relate to feeling like we have two parts to our personalities, each with different agendas. There's the part that wants to get thin and stay that way and is bound and determined to manage our behavior to be successful this time, finally. Then there's another part that whispers in our heads. It's just a little taste. You really deserve to have some. It won't count. Go ahead. No one's watching. You'll start again tomorrow. In Brightline Eating, we call that voice the saboteur. It's the part of us that tries to derail our best plans and intentions. Where does it come from? And why does it try to undermine us like that? In this chapter, we're going to find out. What is consciousness? Many years ago, while I was at the University of Rochester completing my PhD, I had the pleasure of talking with one of the most preeminent neuroscientists of our time, Dr. Michael Gazzaniga, after a talk he gave at the medical school. He was telling me about one of the most interesting things to have emerged from decades of neuroscience research on the brain, the understanding that consciousness doesn't arise from one place, biologically speaking. Rather, each part of the brain that governs an area of function also gives rise to the consciousness about how that function feels. This means the motor cortex doesn't just make you raise your hand. It also produces the awareness of how it feels to raise your hand. The olfactory cortex doesn't just help you smell. It gives you the awareness of what it feels like to do it. In essence, many parts of the brain talk to us. What's important to understand is that even in a very healthy person with no psychological issues, each part of the brain advocates for its own interests and agenda. We often perceive this as thinking. When we get a blister, we get a signal to our brain from our foot, which manifests as a voice inside our head that says, "Ow, this really hurts. I need to stop walking." We weigh that request coming from our heel, but frequently that just isn't an option. So we tell our heel, "I know it hurts, but I can't stop right now, so hang in there." But if we're not savvy about how consciousness is distributed in the brain, when the conversation happens between parts of the brain, we can misperceive the origin of these thoughts. We can perceive all those messages as coming from one integrated I. I'm on a diet. I want to have a drink at the party. I'm not supposed to drink on the diet. I don't want anyone looking at me funny if I don't have a drink. Fine, I'll have the drink. But really, those messages telling you to have the drink you know will derail your weight loss efforts are no more from yourself than your heel telling you it hurts. What I want to teach you to do in this section is to learn to recognize the voice of the saboteur and to be able to talk back to it the way we talk back to our bodies all the time, such as when we push through walking with a blister, teaching with a headache, or being stuck in traffic when we have to pee. Regulating your eating is no different once you understand how the brain works. An experiment. We discussed the brainstem a little in Chapter 2, when we looked at where leptin, the hormone that signals, "I'm full and it's time to get moving," was being blocked. To recap, the brainstem is the most primitive part of the brain. It controls our basest functions, like dilating or constricting our pupils, making urine, and taking in oxygen. Those with sleep apnea probably know that the brainstem is what wakes you up enough to take a breath. It's where our primal drive to survive originates. And the brainstem, too, has a voice. And I want you to meet that voice. So I want you to do a little experiment. What I want you to do is to decide that you're going to hold your breath for 2 minutes. And I mean decide it for real. Decide that everything good you ever wanted to happen in your life is right on the other side of that successful 2 minutes. You're going to relax, get prepared, set a timer, and do it. And as you hold your breath, what I want you to notice is the narrative in your mind. Because at some point within the first minute, it's going to turn from, all right, I'm doing this, I've got this, to, uh-oh, maybe not, to, this is crazy, and then maybe even, screw this. And then you're going to decide to breathe. You're going to judge that nothing bad is really going to happen if you take a breath, and you're going to become really uncomfortable, and there's going to be a voice in your head that tells you, just do it. Breathe. So right now, press pause, go ahead and run the experiment, and come back to me when you're done. And now you're back. And the point I want to hammer home is you didn't decide, that is. You didn't decide to breathe. Your brainstem did, but it got what it wanted from you by convincing you to do it in your own voice. Consciousness is not a unitary phenomenon in the brain. Different parts of the brain create their own consciousness, but to us, they all sound like me. This is where inner conflict comes from. Even incredibly primitive parts of our brain talk to us in our mind with our own voice when they need to direct our behavior. They reason with us, and they win. We think we've chosen our behavior and decided to take a certain action, but that's an illusion. It felt like you decided to take a breath, but you did it because your brain demanded oxygen. You didn't actually have much say. The left hemisphere interpreter. What I want to look at now is what happens in the brain after you've taken that breath you vowed you wouldn't take. In 1967, Dr. Roger Sperry and the aforementioned Michael Gazzaniga, then a PhD student under Sperry at Caltech in Pasadena, published a groundbreaking study, The Split Brain in Man, in the magazine Scientific American. The subjects of their study were four men who'd been the recipients of a surgery that was meant to cure their severe epilepsy. The surgery involved severing a band of fibers called the corpus callosum, that connects and carries signals between the right and the left hemispheres of the brain. 10 men had undergone the experimental surgery when Sperry and Gazzaniga did their research, but only 4 men participated in the study. After the surgery, their epilepsy did improve vastly, but now they had brains whose 2 halves couldn't talk to each other. And Sperry and Gazzaniga wanted to understand exactly what the repercussions would be. What they already knew was that the left hemisphere is the seat of speech and analytical capacity, and that the right hemisphere helps recognize visual patterns. They also knew that the brain and the body crisscross. The left hemisphere controls the right side of the body, and the right hemisphere controls the left side of the body. It's called contralateral control. Even the eyes work this way. So, once the corpus callosum is severed, if you show an image only to the right visual field, only the left hemisphere is going to see it, and vice versa. Fascinating, right? Wait, it gets better. In the study, a man sees a chicken foot in his right visual field, and he's processing it, therefore, in his left hemisphere. And simultaneously, he's seeing a snow-covered house scene in the left visual field, and he's processing that in his right hemisphere. Now, the task he's supposed to accomplish is simply to pick up the card on the table that relates to what he sees. And what happens next is that, because the right hemisphere sees a snow scene, it tells the left hand to pick up a picture of a snow shovel. And simultaneously, the left hemisphere sees a chicken foot and tells the right hand to pick up a picture of a chicken. But then, when the man looks back and forth at both of the cards in his hands, both hemispheres get to separately see them and process what he just did. And then the scientists ask him to explain his choice. Now, language is seated in the left hemisphere, the part of his brain that has seen the chicken foot. So what the man should have said, and what the scientists expected him to say, is, I saw a chicken claw, so naturally I picked out the chicken. But I have no idea why I picked up the snow shovel. That makes no sense at all. But that is not what he said. Instead, he said, the chicken claw goes with the chicken, and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed. And the researcher says, really? That's why you picked up the shovel? And the left brain says, yes. And then the researcher asks, do you remember having that thought when you picked up that card? And the left brain replies, I do. Yeah, I remember having that thought. And of course, that's pure nonsense. His left hemisphere had no such thought. The part of his brain responding to the researcher's question wasn't even the hemisphere that selected that card. But the truly baffling thing is that he never realizes that he's lying to himself. In trial after trial, each of the four men spun confabulations to explain their choices without once picking up on the fact that they were doing it. They never even noticed that they were behaving strangely at all. They completely believed the stories they were telling. It turns out that the job of the left hemisphere is to make sense of our choices, and it's going to come up with an explanation, no matter how bizarre our behavior or how far it has to stretch the truth. For this reason, it's come to be known to neuroscientists as the left hemisphere interpreter. And it works exactly the same, even in people whose corpus callosum hasn't been severed. The implications of this couldn't be more profound. Let's take a moment to connect the dots. As we covered in chapters 2 and 3, our brainstem and our nucleus accumbens generate powerful, driving motivations. If leptin is blocked, the brainstem sends the message, eat. If the dopamine receptors in the nucleus accumbens have downregulated, they demand more in our own voice. And then the left hemisphere interpreter comes along and rationalizes our behavior. So, as we go about our lives, making 4 or 5 failed attempts to lose weight each year, making choices that are 100% incongruent with our goals, with our vows, with the future we most want for ourselves, the left hemisphere is busy contriving stories to explain those choices, regardless of whether those stories make sense. We ate the cupcake because we've had a long day, because we're at a birthday party, because we deserve a treat. Because why start the diet now when we have a cruise coming up in a month and we'll want to enjoy it? Those are the stories the left hemisphere interpreter fabricates to explain the behaviors that originate as demands coming from other parts of the brain. Demands we have no power to deny when we don't even know where they're coming from. No wonder we can't lose weight. The saboteur and self-perception theory. But it goes deeper. One of the most corrosive side effects of the way modern foods and patterns of eating have hijacked our brains is the impact of all of this on our self-perception, how we judge ourselves at the deepest level. Dr. Daryl Bem of Cornell University first posited self-perception theory in 1972. It was a radical theory at the time. It said that we come to know who we are by watching our own behavior. Now, previously, the scientific community thought that self-knowledge drove our behavior. Most people still assume that we know who we are inherently and that we then pick behaviors in alignment with that sense of who we are, in alignment with our beliefs, our values, attitudes, and political leanings. Dr. Bem disagreed. His research showed that we form opinions about ourselves exactly as we form opinions about others, by judging our behaviors. No difference. If a friend is always late, you eventually decide that they are not only an unpunctual person, but probably also a disrespectful one. You do the same to yourself. The psychology of this is very, very upsetting for someone who is high on the susceptibility scale and who has fallen prey to year after year of resolving to eat differently, only to have the brainstem and the nucleus accumbens hijack their resolve. They have eaten foods that they promised themselves they weren't going to eat, or had second and third and fourth helpings when they said they were only going to have one, over and over again. This is the scary thing. If we set goals to eat just these foods and not those foods, and then we watch ourselves decide otherwise in the moment, we watch ourselves lie to ourselves, rationalize our behavior, and betray our highest intentions. Over time, we come to decide that we don't like ourselves, we don't value ourselves, and in some cases, that we loathe ourselves. It's faulty wiring in the brain that demands that we eat, then talks us into thinking that we chose to, and then ultimately makes us conclude that we have deep-seated psychological problems because we can't keep our word to ourselves. Now, some psychologists propose that it's not what you're eating, it's what's eating you. I say it's the opposite. You'll never get to your goal weight by trying to love yourself more or by working on self-acceptance. That's not where the fundamental issue lies. Think of it another way. Do you know yourself to be kind to others? Accomplished at many things? Able to take care of yourself well in many areas? All of that is what's real. You love yourself just fine. The problem isn't what's eating you. It's what you're eating.
Case study, Tammy Oren. Highest weight, 202 pounds. Current weight, 123 pounds. Height, 5 feet 3 inches. When I was 2 years old, my parents divorced. In Israel in 1976, that was not common. They both formed new relationships right away, and I went to live with my mom and my stepdad. My parents did not have the same view of my upbringing, and both families led very different lifestyles. It caused a lot of tension and disagreements over the years, and fundamentally influenced me. When I was 8, I was sent to live with my dad and his new family, and the day I moved to live with them, heartbroken over being made to choose between my parents, I started eating addictively. Even at that young age, I didn't like being overweight, but the more I felt bad about myself, the more I ate, and the bigger I got. I loved food. I absolutely loved food. It was probably my primary relationship. I was raised in Israel, and at that time we didn't really have fast food, and we didn't have snacks in the home like most people have today, and we didn't have sodas. But I was always obsessed with quantities. I loved big portions. I remember always worrying that there wouldn't be enough for me. I'd eat a lot and then finish whatever no one else wanted. Food was so important to me that I'd save my allowance to go eat out. My mother was very controlling, so I would take what little money I had and buy foods that weren't allowed, like big slabs of chocolate or candied nuts. Food was so much more than nourishment to me. In fact, it was everything but nourishment. My first actual diet started when I was 12. I saved my pocket money and purchased the book Diet for Girls, which was mostly about calorie restriction. Very 1986. But at 14, my family moved to a kibbutz, which was another trauma. We had to eat at communal tables, and I remember panicking, thinking, there's not going to be enough food for me. I started eating whatever I could again. I wasn't massive as a teenager, but I was always ashamed of my body and wanted to change it. Then, from age 18 to 20, I did my Israeli military service. I lost all my excess weight at the beginning and kept it off for the whole 2 years. But when I got back to the kibbutz, I put on 22 pounds in 2 months, and the weight just kept coming. I was big, unhappy, and ashamed. I went on my first proper diet when I was 23, just before my wedding. I lost 27 pounds, but after my wedding, I regained it all, plus some. From there, my life followed a typical cycle of trying restrictive diets and losing the weight only to regain it, plus extra. I tried one diet that prescribed quite serious calorie restriction during the day, but